Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 231, and we're going to talk about 10 ways to stay warm this winter. Yep, it's that time. Winter is coming, but there are ways for you to stay nice and toasty in your very own van. We're also going to talk about the Jukla, a new toilet idea that's gotten a lot of traction on Facebook. A tale from the road involving a former hurricane, and a resource recommendation that takes me back to my youth, and I'm very excited to have found it. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you for joining me here once again as we dive into the fascinating world of van life. I hope those of you in the Southeast are ready for what's coming. By the time you're listening to this, it is probable that a very large hurricane has hit Florida and the region, and right on the tails of another one, and I will address that a bit in this episode, but hey, stay safe out there. It is not worth your life to see the thrills of a hurricane. It's not all that interesting, and it is all that dangerous. That said, let's dive into the fortunate or unfortunate fact, depending on your perspective, that winter is coming and your van needs to be ready. So yeah, you have to winterize and do all that stuff. We may talk about that later, but today I want to focus just on ways to heat your van, ways to stay warm in your van. And this doesn't just apply to those of us who live in the north where we actually get snow and stuff. You can be all the way down south in Texas or Alabama or northern Florida, if there's any of it left, and still find the need to heat your van. So I'm going to talk about 10 different ways to heat your van and tell you what's good and what's not so good, in my opinion, and give you some things to think about. And this will apply to those of you who are just building out a van or who already have a van. I've got some solutions here for all of you. So let's jump right in with the obvious one, a diesel heater. And we'll include gasoline heaters too, although they're much rarer and somewhat unsafe in my opinion. But anyway, diesel heater is a little tiny device. It's also called a parking heater. That's about the size of an old thermos, I guess. It's not that big. Maybe a box of saltine crackers. It's kind of that big. And the way it works is it burns diesel to produce heat inside your vehicle with forced air. So the diesel burns in a chamber, there's actually a little glow plug in there, and air is blown over that chamber, taking the heat out and into your van. It takes air from the outside, or the inside, depending on how you do it, and it puts exhaust outside, and it does use 12 volts. These things are the best solution for heat, in my opinion. I have one in my van, my Sprinter 144, I've got a 5 kilowatt in there, and it is a high roof, and that thing will heat that van. No questions, I have no worries about it. Some considerations. First off, you're going to need a supply of diesel. And if you drive a diesel vehicle, hopefully you can tap right into the main tank. A lot of vehicles come with a way to do that. My Sprinter did, although it was an option from the factory. Not all Sprinters have it. If not, you have to have a separate tank to put diesel in. You can actually use kerosene as well if you can't find diesel. And you have to put some time into thinking about where you're going to mount that, because even one drop of diesel fuel will make a big smell in your van. A lot of people don't like that. So you have to think about that, but it's doable. Foresty Forest has lived for years with a diesel heater that uses a separate tank. He has a gasoline van, so that's totally doable. The heat is very dry. It's nice. You can set the thermostat where you'd like, although it doesn't work on temperature. Most of them, anyway, don't work on temperature. They work on hertz, which is how often the pump goes. You'll have to figure out your sweet spot. They usually come with remotes, and they cost anywhere, I mean, you can spend as little as $100 on one of these, and up to $1,500 or more if you want. The good names are Webasto and Eberspacher, but the cheap Chinese diesel heaters with names like Vivor and stuff like that that you can get on Amazon seem to work for most people. So that's going to be my number one recommendation for heating your van if you can do that. This obviously isn't going to work if you're doing a temporary no build or something like that. One other note, you'll find these all-in-one diesel heaters that kind of look like they're in a big kit. They are, but they still have exhaust, so they're still going to have to go through a hole in your van. So don't buy one of those and think, I can just stick this in my van with some bungee cords and be done with it. No, it's not that simple. They still need to be installed or configured in such a way that they actually operate outside your van and just send the hot air in. So don't be fooled by that. They're actually just a metal box with a traditional diesel heater in it. That's really all they are. And one note about diesel heaters, they do require power, and they actually use up to 10 amps of power when they're starting up. So you've got 10 minutes or so of it using 10 amps, and then it drops down to 2 or 3. So you will need a decent battery to use a diesel heater and a way to charge it. Propane forced air heat. If you have an RV, this is probably the kind of heat you have. It works just like your furnace in your house, basically. It burns propane, same thing as the diesel heater, really. There's this combustion chamber that gets hot, air is blown over the combustion chamber, and the warm air fills your van. And this is dry heat. You will hear talk about propane producing wet heat. Forced air propane produces dry heat, which is what you want. And it exhausts the gas out the side. These things are frequently installed in RVs. It's the most common heater you're going to find, and you can put one in your van. But there are reasons why you might not want to. Now, while propane heaters don't use as much power on startup as diesel heaters, they end up using more power over time because they're turning a bigger fan. These have a big squirrel cage fan in them, and they just use more power. It's not a terrible amount, maybe 4 amps or so, depending on the size of your unit, and they go through a lot of propane. If you were to use one of those, you know, 1-pound green bottles with one of these kind of heaters, it would last a matter of hours. You would certainly not get through the night with that. So they're not a good solution for people using those bottles. You need to have a big tank. And other than that, they're great, but they take up a lot of space. You need a big hole in the side of your van, usually. Some of them have a little hole. It's not so bad. But inside your van, they're going to take up as much space as a dorm fridge, say. They take up a lot of space. So that's why not too many people install these in their vans. Those that do tend to install the Propex ones, which are fine, but they are kind of expensive. However, properly done and with the proper resources, they will provide a nice, cozy environment for you. Number 3, catalytic heaters. Most people refer to these as buddy heaters because that's one of the brand names. Olympian by Camco is another brand name, and there's a few others. These are a little different. These are a flat panel. Imagine, just throwing out things here, the size of a small pizza box, maybe, that you can mount to the wall or you can put on stands, and they give off heat, not by burning propane, but by catalyzing it. What's interesting about these is that they don't, quote unquote, need to be exhausted. You don't have to run a pipe outside. So if you're in a no build or a build where you don't have the ability to drill a hole in your van, say, these can work. But that comes with a huge caveat. These heaters will produce a good amount of heat, although it's radiant heat. It's not the air that's heated, it's the objects in front of the heater that are heated, and then those objects radiate heat back into the air. It's very directional heat. If you're standing behind the catalytic heater, you probably won't feel any heat at all. It's very different from the other kind of heaters we've talked about. These things will pump out some carbon dioxide, and they will pump out a lot of moisture. These things will make the inside of your van damp, because when you burn propane, it produces moisture. So you're going to need ventilation with these. You're going to need to have a roof vent open or a window open or something like that. And some people say, well, that just lets all the heat out. And you have a point. You do have a point. But, that's just life in the big city with one of these heaters. It's a trade-off. These will work on those 1-gallon cans. And I'm going to talk about those in the news segment in just a bit. In my experience, I have an Olympian Wave 3, which is the smallest of the Camco Olympian models. It will last the night on a green bottle if I set it on low, and that was for my NV200, but it did not make the entire van toasty warm by any means. Anything that wasn't in the direct line of sight, to say, from that heater really didn't get warm, and I had a huge temperature inversion in the van where the roof, and again, it's a low roof van, the roof was like 85, it was nice up there, but the floor was 30. I literally could have something frozen on the floor and something like warm to the touch at the ceiling. So I'm not a big fan of these heaters. They excel in portability, which is something that none of the others do. So they're great for that. And they can survive the night on a disposable can, but there's probably better options. Number 4, 12-volt electric heat. Somebody on Facebook posted today in a bunch of the groups, what is the best 12-volt electric heater? And the responses were predictable, like, no. You can't have that. So why not? Well, the problem is that heating stuff with 12 volts uses a ton of power. Whether it's a hairdryer or a toaster or anything else, an electric space heater is going to, they're all going to use a ton of power, and you're going to need so much battery to get the heat you want out of these that you're going to find you don't have a way to charge it. Now, if you are plugged in, if you're at a campground or you're able to plug in, one of those really inexpensive $20 space heaters from Home Depot, that's 1500 watts, that'll heat your van just fine. But it's going to use a lot of power, and most people can't do that just off batteries. And also, they're 110, they're not 12 volts. So while you can buy little 12-volt heaters like as defrosters or something like that, they're going to kill your batteries really fast. So I would recommend that if you go that route, use them only while you're driving. Like if you want to get some warm air in the back of your van while you're driving, yeah, you could plug in one of these 12-volt heaters and kind of pre-warm it. But once you're stopped and running off battery power, these are not a solution. It's just not practical. Number 5, the AC heat pump. If you are one of those few van life folks who's fortunate enough to have an air conditioner and it has a heat pump feature, and you figured out how to power it either with a giant bank of batteries or you're fortunate enough to be plugged in or whatever, some of those air conditioners come with a heat pump. Actually, I should back up here. There's two options for air conditioning heat. One is a heat strip, which is basically what we just talked about. It's a toaster. And the other is a heat pump, which reverses the air conditioning process. And you can think of it this way. It's not heating your van. It's cooling the outside. If you think of how an air conditioner works, you've got cold air coming out of one side and hot air coming out of the other. A heat pump is a reversible air conditioner, and you can reverse it. They work great under certain circumstances. One, they draw a lot of power, which is kind of a given. The other is that they kind of stop working about 40 degrees Fahrenheit or say 10 degrees Celsius, somewhere around there. And so if it's 50 and, you know, it's 50 or it's 16 or whatever that is in Celsius and, you know, you're just a little chilly, yeah, a heat pump can warm things up. But they're not a reliable solution for most people because you can't use them if it's below freezing at all. They simply won't work. We have a heat pump in our air conditioner in the Airstream, and I've used it a few times, and it's a little weird. It actually draws more power than the air conditioner when it's running, and then every 20 minutes it goes through this defrost cycle where steam comes out of it, and it makes weird noises, and honestly, we have better results with just a cheap space heater. Our 1,500-watt space heater will heat almost the entire 27-foot Airstream on days where it's in the 30s. So I think that's a better option. But heck, if you're going to put an air conditioner in and you have the option for a heat pump, yeah, you know, whatever. Go ahead and put it in. Number 6, now we're getting super practical. An electric blanket. So I recommended against these several years ago, but battery technology has improved, prices have come down, and yeah, you can use an electric blanket in your rig. It is probably the most economical way to heat your van. Again, it's not going to heat your van, it's only going to heat what it's wrapped around, especially on battery power. So there's two different approaches to this. One is you can get a traditional electric blanket with a thermostat that you would use in a house, run it on an inverter, and then run it off your batteries. Now, as we've talked about many times, inverters are inherently inefficient. You're going to lose 10 to 30% of your power, except where does that 10 to 30% of your power that you're losing go? Well, it becomes heat. So you're really not losing it in this case. It's helping to heat the van a little bit. But it is practical to have 200, 300, 400 amp hours of battery and use an electric blanket overnight with no problem. What I do and has worked for me is I have a 12-volt electric blanket, a decent quality one. It's one that's washable, I can remove the controls from, and I run that off of a, let's just call it a Jackery for this. It's a knockoff, but we'll call it a Jackery. I have a Jackery 500, and that has enough power to actually power my 12-volt electric blanket as long as I want. And the trick is that in your bed or however you have it set up, you want to crawl into your bed or your sleeping bag, put the electric blanket on top of you, and then put another blanket on top of that. That will keep you toasty in all but the coldest conditions. And it's pretty inexpensive, too. And yes, I'll have links in the show notes to a bunch of these things if you want to look. But don't discount the electric blankets. They actually can be a good solution. Number 7, Sterno and other things that burn. I'm afraid I'm guilty of this. I used to use Sterno to heat my tent in the mornings when I was tent camping. I just had a little can of Sterno there, and I'd just light it up, and after a few minutes, the tent would be fairly toasty warm. And then I caught the tent on fire. I should do this as a tale from the road. I ended up putting the fire out with my wallet, which was also not a great idea because my wallet caught on fire. Maybe I will tell that some other time. But anyway, I would use this in emergencies only. Any kind of open flames in your vehicle is a bad idea. And this actually goes for using the stove to heat your van too. I know there's a prominent YouTuber out there who's done a lot of van life and says that he heats his entire van with just his Coleman stove. But that open flame is dangerous inherently, and it also does give off gases that can be dangerous, and you need to ventilate and all that. So in general, I avoid open flames in my vehicle, no matter whether they're a candle or a sterno or propane or anything like that. I think it's a bad idea. That doesn't mean I haven't done it, but it also doesn't mean I haven't burned my wallet in the process. Number 8, butane. This is an interesting one. So I like butane for cooking. I like those little portable stoves. You put the butane thing in. Those are great. Some of them have a heater option where there's this flip over and it turns into a heater. And, you know, they can kind of work. They're technically an open flame, but in a pinch, they work. You're going to run into the problem of trying to find the butane cans. You've always got that problem. They do create the waste of the butane can you have to throw away. Although, if you puncture the can, you can treat it just like an aerosol can, and that's not a big deal. But they get very, very hot. It's easy to burn yourself on one of these. And they're kind of cheap, so it makes you wonder about the safety factors. There is a concern that some of these will actually not kill you with gases, but kill you by eating up all the oxygen in the van. I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway, I would be wary of using butane for heating. Also, it produces a whole lot of moisture, just like the propane ones do, and butane freezes at a higher temperature than propane. So if it's like 25 degrees Fahrenheit and you've left your butane in the van, it could actually be frozen, and then you need to warm it up so that you could use it. And you don't warm it up by holding a lighter over it. You warm it up by putting it next to your body inside your clothes. That's how you warm things like that up. Number 9, I use this all the time. I think it's great. It's wonderful. It's cheap. It's effective. Hot water bottles. Old-fashioned hot water bottles. Water holds a lot of energy. We don't really realize just how much energy it holds. But look at boiling a pot of spaghetti. Look how much heat you have to apply to that pot in order to get the water boiling. Well, if you take some of that water and put it in a hot water bottle and put it at the bottom of your sleeping bag, that's going to keep you warm for longer than you think. And, well, let me just lay this out here. The warm liquid doesn't have to be water. Wink, wink. Nudge, nudge. If you have, say, another container that has another warmish liquid in there, as long as it's tightly sealed, it can help keep you warm, too, if you're willing to take risks. And number 10, engine heat. Yeah, you can start your engine, and heat will come out. Not a great idea. A lot of people have died from carbon monoxide poisoning because they've left their vehicle running all night. That's a little bit less of a concern now, but it's still a concern. It's not good for your engine. It uses gasoline or diesel, and I'm not a fan. Nope, I don't like it. I don't like it. I know people do it. What some people have in fancy RVs, and including my ambulance, is that the engine heat has antifreeze lines that go all the way in the back and will actually heat the back from the engine. So on a really cold day, I will heat the back of my van with engine heat while I'm driving. And then when I stop, turn off the engine, it's already pre-warmed back there and I just have to maintain that temperature, which is a lot easier. And a bonus! Those little hot hand things, you've seen these, you've ever been to a ski resort or something, these little packets that you open up and they get hot, yeah, those can be super useful. If you toss a couple of those in your sleeping bag, they can help keep you warm. You put one at your core that you can grab with your hands during the night and one down by your feet, and yeah, you've got 8 hours of warmth there in reasonable conditions. Of course, having a good sleeping bag is part of that equation too. So anyway, I hope that you stay warm this winter, but you keep doing the van thing, because vanning in the winter, it's its own special kind of cool. Thanks to all my donors this week. I had an anonymous donor this week that I'm especially appreciative of, but since they're anonymous, I can't tell you who they are. But for the rest of you, if you enjoy listening to a podcast without ads, the way to do that is to support the program by going to buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Buy me a gallon of diesel and you will help stave off the ads that plague our lives every day. Also, there's another way to help, and I'll have a link in the show notes. I am a big fan of the Amazon Prime Visa. I've used it for over 20 years. All the rewards simply go onto your Amazon account, and if you're building out a van, you're going to spend some money on Amazon. It's dead simple, lots of discounts for things you buy on Amazon, and I highly recommend it. Now, there's a link in the show notes. If you follow my link, that will also help directly support the podcast. And you and everybody else will have my thanks. Van Life News. Whoa, we've got a mixed bag here this week, but at least it's not all negative as it is some weeks. In 2026, Mercedes-Benz electric vans will hit the road with midsize and camper vans coming to the U.S. Well, folks, that's what the headline says. Do we believe it? Not inherently. We will believe it when we see it. However, in this article, which is in MSN but actually comes from Gear Junkie, there are pictures of the van. And apparently they're doing road testing with some. They're all painted with dazzle paint, so you can't tell what they are. The project is called van.ea, V-A-N.ea. These are electric vans, and they are saying that they're going to have an electric camper van built by Mercedes entirely in the U.S. in 2026. Again, I will believe it when I see it. Currently, these vans are being spotted in Sweden, but we are not in Sweden. Well, I'm not in Sweden. You might be. I wish I was in Sweden, because I could really use a cardamom roll right now. But, yeah. If you happen to see one of these vans on the road, please let me know at jeff@builttogo.com, and I will be sure to mention it to others. But it would be nice to see a factory-made camper van. We really haven't had an automotive manufacturer make a camping vehicle directly since the GM motorhomes were made in the 70s. So it would be nice to see that again, because automotive quality tends to be superior to RV quality, and, well, more quality is good. Okay, here's the big news for this week, and this is going to affect a lot of people. California bans non-reusable propane cylinders. That's right, folks. California has signed a law that they are going to ban the sale of those green 1-pound propane bottles that are oh so popular in the state of California. Now, I know people say a lot of things about the state of California. I get it. They have some rather unusual and unique laws. But they also are a bit of a trendsetter. And I think this is the end of these green cans, green bottles, or at least the start of it. And that's a good thing, because these things are kind of a menace. They're difficult to dispose of. You can't really throw them away legally, and you can't recycle them legally. And so what's happened at places like Yosemite and Yellowstone is that they end up in this big pile by some ranger station until they find a way to deal with it. And I know people refill them, and I also know that it's very unsafe to refill them, because these cans can't take it. They're subject to metal fatigue, and the valves are weak. They're only meant for one-time use. So you are taking your life in your hand if you refill one of these things. And it's illegal to move them once they're refilled, at least in the U.S. So what I think is going to happen is we're going to see reusable one-pound cans emerge, which we already have. These exist. You can buy a reusable one-pound can right now. But we don't have is a swap system. And I think and hope what we'll end up with is, just like you can go get a pre-filled 20-pound can for your gas grill, you'll be able to grab a 1-pound can too. You just bring your old ones in, pop them in a machine, it'll give you new ones. Maybe it's just a vending machine. We actually have a propane vending machine that uses the 20-pound bottles in Peru, Illinois, that I visit fairly often at Menards. Maybe we'll find that. And then, boy, that'd be great. I mean, we wouldn't have any waste. The only issue is you'd have to carry the can around with you, but, you know, no big deal. So I see this as a good thing. I think it's progress. I think it will take us forward to a better way of doing things. But California's going to be first, and we will see what happens. Finally, for those of you who are stuck in the current hurricane situation, I don't know if this message is going to make any difference by the time you hear it, but the Atlanta Motor Speedway is providing free camping for anybody during the Hurricane Milton event. If you need a place to stay and you can get to Atlanta, you can go to the Atlanta Motor Speedway and they will give you a place to park. And of course, they have some support there. You know, there's bathrooms, there's probably electricity in some places. There should be cell phone service, all that. It's a place to go if you need a place to camp. So I will have a link for that in the show notes, but you could probably just search Atlanta Motor Speedway Milton and find the details on that. So I hope that helps somebody. And kudos to the Atlanta Motor Speedway for doing some good where it was most needed. Tech Talk, the cigarette lighter plug 12-volt alligator clip cord. The what? Okay, I have had some interesting experiences with 12 volts lately, and I found several times where I needed alligator clips that were hot for 12 volts. I mean, not hot for 12 volts, that were hot and giving off 12 volts. That sounds a lot better. Now, jumper cables are this, right? If you take jumper cables and hook them up to your battery, the other end is 12 volts hot. Okay, but I needed it portable. I needed it to work off my Jackery. Now, I have a Jackery Explorer 1500 now, and it has a bunch of ports. It has a cigarette lighter port. It has a bunch of barrel plug ports. But how do I get 12 volts out of that to plug into something that doesn't have a normal plug at the other end? For example, this isn't what I was doing, but what if I wanted to jumpstart a battery with my Jackery? Now, don't do that. It's just the example that I can give you so you know what I'm talking about. Well, it doesn't come with any cords to do that, but they do sell a cord like that on Amazon, and I think it's a great idea. What this thing is it's a cigarette lighter plug on one end and then alligator clips on the other, and that will let you give 12 volts to anything as long as you can hook alligator clips onto it. And you might be saying, well, like what? Well, here's an example. My Tiki Bago needs to be winterized. It has a water pump. I need to turn on the water pump in order to get the pink liquid to go through the water pump and make it safe for the winter. But the battery in the Tiki Bago is dead. And I don't just mean dead. It's dead. How about less than a volt dead? The thing's had it. That's my fault. I should probably tell that whole story too. But anyway, I needed to get 12 volts temporarily into the Tiki Bago, or at least to the water pump. How do I do that? Yeah, I could drive a truck over there and hook it up with the jumper cables. I could do that. Or I could just bring my Jackery over and use one of these cables with alligator clips and hook it up either to where the battery goes in the Tiki Bago, directly to the water pump, to the fuse block. I could hook it up anywhere I could reach. And that's exactly what I did. And now the Tiki Bago is all winterized and the Jackery saved the day. I can think of a lot of uses for these things, such as testing appliances. Let's say you have some LED lights you're putting in and you're not sure what the polarity is, because LED lights have polarity. You have to hook positive to positive and negative to negative, or your LED lights will not light. Well, this would be a great way to test that. Plug in your plug to the Jackery and put your alligator clips on the leads, and when it lights, mark one side as positive and you're good to go. It's kind of a field 12-volt test station, if nothing else. Plus, if you have a Jackery or something similar, it'll actually tell you how many amps are being drawn and things like that, too. So this actually sounds like a product review, but I'm saying this more to let you know that such things exist. That's why I put it in the Tech Talk part. And I'm going to have a link in the show notes for this cable, but it will turn any power station into a portable 12-volt source for testing anything. Now, to address the jump-starting thing, don't try to jump-start your vehicle with your power station. It's a bad idea. You will damage your power station. That's not how these batteries are designed. However, if you're in an emergency situation and you need to get some power to your engine battery to, say, run accessories, you can do that with this. And if you absolutely need to try to start your truck because there's a train coming or something, whatever, do it over time. Hook your Jackery up to your starter battery and leave it there for as long as you can so that your Jackery will slowly bring your starter battery up to 12 volts. It's probably not going to work because you actually need more than 12 volts to charge it effectively. But heck, you can give it a try. So anyway, I'll have a link in the show notes for this cable. It's cheap. It's less than 10 bucks. It's 15 amps, so it's pretty robust. And you never know when you're going to need just a flexible 12 volts to test something or to power something in an emergency. I'm really glad I have this thing. Now, product review. Here's the real product review, except it isn't because I don't have the product. I've just seen this thing advertised on Facebook a few times and I thought I have to check this thing out. It's called a Jukla. And it turns out Jukla is a camping company from Australia. And they have invented yet another toilet because, you know, clearly we haven't solved the toilet problem because there's so many different ways to do it. You've got your cassette toilet and your black tank toilets and your composting toilets and ye old bucket. You've got all those options. What if there was a solution that was portable, required no power, and yet was kind of all the things I just mentioned? That's what Jukla is trying to do. It is a separating toilet. It will separate liquids from solids. Main reason for that is that liquids and solids, when mixed, create the horrible smell we're all trying to avoid. Also, you want to deal with solids differently than liquids, depending. It's much easier to get rid of the liquids, right? So this one toilet has three different ways of dealing with this. The liquids go into a bucket, you dispose of that properly, nice and easy, just like any composting toilet out there. But the solids container has three different solutions. The first is, it can be just a regular old cassette toilet. The solids container comes out just like a cassette, it seals tightly, and you can actually buy extra ones if you're going to be on an extended trip, you can just store the full ones, and it works the same way. However, if you don't like the idea of that, or you're camping in the winter and you need a dry situation, you can put a bag in it. And it has a system where when you take it out, the bag twists, kind of like a diaper genie, and then you can just dispose of the bag. I understand that's controversial. To me, it's no different than dealing with picking up after your dog. And then the final way is, yeah, folks, it can be a quote-unquote composting toilet. Now, caveat here, composting toilets, don't do any composting. You have to... You maybe start the process and compost somewhere else. Yeah, no, this ignores all that. This isn't really a composting toilet at all. It just stores the waste in the same manner as what we call composting toilets do. So you can put some sawdust in there or some coconut coir or something like that. Now, there's no stirrer. It actually comes with a stick. And the stick ostensibly isn't to stir. The stick is to push down anything that gets stuck in the bowl. But okay, we know people are going to use the stick for different things. Anyway, the point is you then end up with a bucket full of the same stuff that you'd find in a composting toilet, and you can dispose of it the same way. So that's an option too. Now back to the stick. The stick is really there in case some toilet paper gets stuck to the rim. You can use the stick to push the toilet paper in. But then what? The bowl, you know, despite it having a generous opening, the bowl may not be entirely clean when you're done with this process. Well, it also comes with a built-in spray bottle that you can spray down the edges and clean, and that little bit of liquid going into that tank isn't going to be terrible. And heck, you can use alcohol if you want, and then that will evaporate. You want to keep your solids dry as possible. Now, there's no fan, so there's not going to be any desiccating, and any odors produced can escape, and that's why it's airtight. It has a thing that seals over it. The best news about this thing is that it's under $300. It's a lot cheaper than a composting toilet. And if you were in the market for a composting toilet, I think you should take a look at these. Now, I haven't tried them. I can't tell you anything about them other than that. I know they're on back order right now because they're so popular having just come out. Compared to a cassette toilet, these are expensive. However, they give you more options. Compared to a composting toilet, these are dirt cheap. So I'll have a link in the show notes. You can check it out for yourself. Again, I have not tested this. And heck, if anyone at Jukla is listening, send me a unit. I'll stick it in my van and drive around with it, and I will give an actual real-world review. But I'm very intrigued by the concept, and as long as they didn't cut corners on the build quality, I think this is going to be my number one way of dealing with bathroom necessities in a van, if they didn't cut back on quality, etc., etc. So I've got a link in the show notes. It's just jukla.com, JOOCLA.com. They've got other stuff too, but I'm just interested in this particular thing. Tales from the road. So, since there's a hurricane coming to whack Florida, I thought maybe I'd tell you a hurricane story. I've got a few hurricane stories, but this one kind of relates to the situation in Florida a bit, and, well, maybe there's a lesson in here. Maybe not. We'll see. Years ago in 2017, Hurricane Irma came to Florida and laid waste to the region south of Tampa, Fort Myers, Sanibel, Lehigh Acres, etc., going across the state. And at the time, my folks had a long-term rental on Sanibel, and we were concerned about it, basically, because it was on the beach, and Sanibel had sustained a lot of damage. Although nothing like they sustained a couple years ago, when basically the whole island was wiped out. There's very little there on Sanibel now that I recognize, and it's kind of sad. But at any rate, my parents' condo was on the second floor, so we weren't too worried about water damage unless the windows broke or something. And it was by the lighthouse, Lighthouse Point. If you're familiar at all with Sanibel, Lighthouse Point is a key spot, and there's only a little bit left now. The lighthouse is still there. It may not be next week. We'll see. At any rate, I got all the proper permits and stuff and drove down there from Chicago, and I thought, you know, I'm going to check on the condo, but I also want to help out. So I literally stopped at Menards on the way, filled up the car with stuff, you know, my smart car. We're back in the smart car days here. Filled up the smart car with stuff. I was ready to go. I had extra food and water. I had everything to take care of me. And then what space was left, again, smart car, I filled up with tools and donated goods and things like that. And on the way down, I stopped in Atlanta and met some friends, and they gave me some stuff too. And then I was going to go save Florida all by myself. I mean, not really, but I thought, you know, I would go help out. And so I drove down there, got to the island, and I was like the only person on the island. Now, I had permission to be there. It was okay for me to be there. Being a resident because of the rented condo, I was allowed there. And that was fine. But when I got to the island, what I saw was, yes, some damage. The condo was fine. The power had gone out. A railing blew off. You know, little stuff. It was easy to fix. But the island itself, there were no people. There were no people at all on the island. Now, this is an island the size of Manhattan. So it was kind of eerie driving around, and there was just no people anywhere. Except for the electrical workers. I must have counted 80 different electrical trucks on the island setting up power again. And I thought, holy cow, they are on it. They're down here. They're getting the power back. This is amazing. I'm so stunned at how fast they're doing this. This was like a day after the hurricane rolled through. And so, okay, I fixed all the stuff at the condo I needed to fix. And I was like, well, where should I go from here? And so I went to a local agency called Fish, which is kind of a food bank type of thing. I helped them out a bit. I moved some stuff from the Salvation Army to them and did some things, and that was great. But I wanted to do more. And so I found a local food bank that was bigger. I'm going to withhold their name for a very good reason. And I made an arrangement to go help them out. But they were deep in Lee County. They weren't really near Sanibel. So it was a bit of a drive to get there. And that was fine. I didn't have anything else to do. So I drove there and I got to Fort Myers. And I stopped at Fort Myers to see what it was like. And Fort Myers got hit a lot harder than Sanibel. There was a lot of stuff down. But the Walmart was open. I was like, oh, wow, the Walmart's open. So I pulled in, went into the Walmart, and it was devastated, not from storm damage, although the Home Depot next door was nearly destroyed. The Walmart was open, but the shelves were just about empty. There was nothing fresh at all. Every single item of produce or meat or anything like that was gone. All those shelves were empty. And the canned goods, there weren't very many at all. But I did see some Progresso soup way back in a shelf that somebody had missed. And I grabbed the can and I was like, wow, this is great. I found a can of soup and I'm going to buy this. And then I stopped myself. Because what am I doing? I don't need this can of soup. I made sure that I brought enough supplies for myself that I didn't need to be a burden on the local community. Buying that soup makes me a burden because there are other people there with no food who need that soup. So I put it back on the shelf and left Walmart without buying anything because I didn't need anything. It was just like, wow, I found something that made me think I should buy something. So that was a lesson there. If you are ever in a disaster area and you have your own means, don't take them away from anybody else. The next town I went to is called Lehigh Acres. It's right next to Fort Myers. And what I saw there really bothered me. Now, Sanibel Island is a very wealthy community. A lot of famous people live on Sanibel. You have to have money to live there. Heck, it costs $6 just to get there every time crossing the bridge. It's a nice place, or at least it was. I don't know what it's like now, but we really enjoyed our time there. But it is not an impoverished community. Lehigh Acres sort of is. Lehigh Acres isn't where the money is. And there was no power. And people had put big pieces of plywood in front of their houses saying, "Help, no power, we need help." And they were all over the place. And it was hot. This was in the fall. It was September. And the temperatures there were in the 90s and very humid. No air conditioning. And people were just sweltering in their homes. And what I didn't see is what bothered me. I didn't see a single power truck there. None. They were all on Sanibel, where there were no people, because those were second homes for most people. They didn't have to be there. And they had money to fix things themselves. They didn't need that much support. I found out later that the city of Sanibel, very smartly, had contracted privately with electric companies to fix all the power in case there was a storm. Lehigh Acres didn't have that option. So the folks in Lehigh Acres suffered greatly during this storm, simply because they weren't wealthy. And I don't like that. I don't think that's fair. So driving around there, it just seemed like this was the wrong place to be. And I quickly learned that wanting to help does not translate into being able to help. You can't just single-handedly go into a disaster and think you're going to offer any kind of help. You need to be attached to an organization. You need their support because they're ready for you. They know what's going on. You don't. You're just going to be in the way. It's called self-deploying. It's a bad thing. So I went to the food bank and I helped out there. I was sorting food and building pallets and all that kind of stuff. And now I'm going to save the food bank for another story because what happened there was not good. But I left the food bank and then I found Team Rubicon in an ad on Google. And that's how I ended up with Team Rubicon for all those years. I'm no longer with Team Rubicon, but it was a great experience. I had so many opportunities, I can't even tell you what a change it made in my life. And so, the point of this story is, if you want to help out in times of disaster, you can't just show up. You have to be attached to an organization, but that's not hard to do. If you've got time, join an organization like Team Rubicon and let them know, and they will get you out in the field at their expense. Team Rubicon, if you use them, they will fly you down there, house you, feed you, train you, and get you in the field helping people. It's wonderful, and it's the best way to help. And if you don't have time, but you have money, send money donations to Team Rubicon or Red Cross or Salvation Army or whatever organization you know that's doing good down there. Do not send anything other than those two things. Don't send water, don't send teddy bears, don't send food. All that stuff just gets in the way. The organizations working down there know best how to handle resources. Just give them resources. So I learned a lot from that. It ended up changing my life. And my heart goes out to all the folks in the Southeast who are suffering right now. I've seen what it's like firsthand. But I want you all to know, if you happen to be listening to this podcast, there is help out there. And if you don't know how to find it, get on Crisis Cleanup. That is where all the organizations get their work orders from. There should be phone numbers posted around or on Facebook, or you can Google Crisis Cleanup on a computer. And they will be the best way for you to get help. Good luck to you. A place to visit. Well, I can't say I've been to this place. And if I ever drove by this place, I may have stopped and turned around to drive by it again, only because of the name. And that name is the Pooseum. Yeah, P-O-O-Z-E-U-M. The Pooseum. Ladies and gentlemen, Williams, Arizona has the world-famous Dinosaur Poop Museum and Gift Shop. That's right, folks. If you have a craving for dinosaur poop, they've got it here, and you can visit it. This place has been there for 10 years, and their slogan is, "We're number one for fossilized number two." Now, you may wonder why you would want some fossilized dinosaur poo, which is officially called a coprolite. And I might wonder why, too. But if it is what you are desiring, they have it. And it is actually interesting stuff. I mean, we learned a lot about what dinosaurs ate and what conditions they were living under just by their poop. Honestly, we've learned a lot about ancient humans the same way. And The largest coprolite by a carnivorous animal is owned by George Franzen, and it was 67.5 centimeters long and 15.7 centimeters wide. That's pretty big. He also personally owns 1,277 coprolites as certified in 2015. So, folks, I can't say that today's composting toilet output will end up in a museum someday, but who knows? 20,000 years from now, there may be a van life museum, and you could contribute to it, but who knows? At any rate, if you'd like to see the museum and possibly pick up your very own piece of fossilized dinosaur poo, you can do that in Williams, Arizona, at the Pooseum. Now, they're only open Wednesday through Sunday, so Mondays and Tuesday, you'll have no luck. Link in the show notes. Resource recommendation. This resource recommendation kind of sidetracked me from finishing the podcast week because I was so fascinated by it. When I joined Boy Scouts, I learned a lot about camping, etc., etc., but one of my favorite things I learned about was how to tie knots, and I still use those knots that I learned how to tie today. I tie clove hitches when I'm bored and on the phone. I tie bowlines for just about everything. Tautland hitches are great for keeping your tent cables snug. I even use timber hitches to haul logs through the woods to half hitches. I mean, a lot of these knots I use all the time, and if you ever wondered how to tie these knots, for example, if you want to learn how to tie the famed sheep shank, which actually isn't that hard, this site will show you. The name of the site is animatedknots.com, and boy, they've got everything. They've got a website, they have an app, they have a YouTube channel, all these different ways to show you how to tie knots, and they do an excellent job of it. It's a catalog of knots, and each knot shows however many pieces of rope are needed. It's usually two. One red, one blue. And then there's an animated GIF that shows you how to tie it one step at a time, and a YouTube video that shows you how to tie it if you want to see the whole thing done in real time. It also talks a little bit about what knots are best for what. Clove hitches are good for lashing. Bowlines, as the name might suggest, is good for bows, or it's basically a loop that won't close upon itself. Two half hitches is just a good knot for tying a loop that you can wrap around something, and so on and so forth. Some of these knots are magic. The mooring hitch, which I have used many times, is a magic knot. You tie this knot, and you can pull on the rope as hard as you want. It won't come undone, but then there's one loose piece, and if you pull on that, it falls apart instantly. It's a great knot for mooring boats, hence the name. It's kind of nice. Most of the knots have names that make sense. But if you would like to learn about knots, and I'll tell you what, folks, van life, camping, all that, there are many, many times when you wish you knew how to tie a knot. This will be a fun and effective way of learning all the knots to make your lives better. Bonus tip, if you're using dental floss, a figure eight knot can make your dental floss much more effective. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 231. Holy cow, it's been a long time. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And if you would like to join in the fun, please consider joining our Discord channel or our Facebook group, both of which are linked at builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And until next time, remember the words of Aristotle, who said, not in English, "To appreciate the beauty of a snowflake, it is necessary to stand out in the cold."